shot during their first week on campus, and someone goosed him. His pool cue flew across the table, and he turned around with a look that warned everyone that here was a serious fellow. The Fordham campus and its surroundings seemed isolated from the grit of the metropolis. A calming preserve of natural beauty extended from the world-famous zoo to the New York Botanical Gardens and onto the school property itself. 70 acres of cobblestone paths, gray stone Gothic buildings, and rolling greenswards shaded by graceful elms. The faculty of Jesuits, robed in full-length black cassocks, strolled the paths of the quadrangle, carrying missals and saying their office. The athletic director, Jack Coffey, prided himself on memorizing the birthday of every student. "Hello, June 11th," he chirped upon greeting young Lombardi. The campus was so evocative of academic serenity that it was a favorite choice for collegiate movie scenes. There was some clanging in the center of it all, where construction had begun on Keating Hall, but the noise was greeted as a sign of vitality. The majestic frontispiece of Keating rising skyward as a symbol that Fordham, founded in 1841 as the first Catholic institution of higher learning in the Northeast United States, was flourishing even amid the economic hardship of the Depression years. The Jesuits sought to impose strict discipline on the men who lived there, and Lombardi mostly accepted it. From his sparely furnished freshman room on the fifth floor of Dealey, high-ceilinged with a creaky wooden floor, he awoke each morning at 6:30, dressed in coat and tie, put on his maroon-bowed miraculous medal depicting the Blessed Mother, and followed the path to chapel for daily mass before breakfast and class. He had few options in his coursework. Like many football players, he studied business administration, but only three courses separated that major from most others. All undergraduates essentially followed the same curriculum, the Jesuits' favored ratio studiorum, which emphasized the retention of knowledge in the first 2 years and an integration of that knowledge into a spiritual philosophy in the final two. Freshmen were loaded down with as many as 8 courses per semester, while seniors had only 4, with an increasing emphasis on philosophy, psychology, religion, and ethics. All Fordham men were expected to have an acquaintance with classical languages, which Lombardi already had fulfilled by taking Latin and Greek at Cathedral and St. Francis. At Fordham, he studied French. There was no sleeping in or skipping class. Attendance was mandatory and tests came unceasingly. The Reverend Joseph Asmuth, S.J., biology professor for underclassmen, perhaps seemed inimitable, yet he was representative of the Jesuits who instructed Lombardi. Most of them had idiosyncratic touches. All were demanding. Asmuth was considered a world authority on termites. Students couldn't chew gum in his class. "That is for cows," he would proclaim in his German accent. "We don't chew." He did not use textbooks, but scrawled everything on the blackboard for students to take down, essentially creating a textbook over the course of the year. And he kept everyone anxious. One never knew which day of the week he would stride in and bellow, "Blitz!" as assistants passed out the dreaded surprise quiz. After classwork and football practice, Lombardi was expected back in his room no later than 8 on weekdays, with lights out by 10:30. The Jesuits conducted room checks. To demonstrate their obedience, Lombardi and Lawler stepped out into the hall, fell on their knees, and uttered their nightly prayers. On weekends, the boarders could escape the campus, but had to return by 11, midnight for upperclassmen, and report to the residence hall prefect or dean of discipline, Father John W. Tynan, S.J., Blackjack, the students called him, on the way back to their rooms. John Barris, one of Lombardi's classmates, thought that it was just like a monastery up there. They locked the gates, they wouldn't let you out. Everything was a sin. You had this stuff drilled into you. But football players often exhibit split personalities, willing to exist in an authoritarian environment, yet always looking for small ways to rebel. In their first weeks at Fordham, some freshman ballplayers learned how to sneak from room to room by climbing out the window and moving along the ledge while clinging to the mansard roof. Later, many of them, including Lombardi, discovered they could fool the Jesuits, who checked their breath for alcohol at night by chewing garlic cloves after drinking. It took only one day of practice for the new head coach at Fordham to decide that his young recruit from Brooklyn was not going to become a backfield star. James H. Crowley watched Vinnie Lombardi play fullback that opening day, then motioned for freshman coach Ed Hunsinger to come over. "Too slow," said Crowley. "Switch the kid to the front." The next day, Lombardi was playing guard. He was frustrated by the move and had difficulty adjusting from the upright position of a fullback to the three-point stance of a lineman. His hip pads bothered him. Nearsighted and colorblind, he complained about what he saw up there on the line. The opponents looked too close to him, separated only by the width of the ball. But he became a guard. That move of positions from fullback to guard, in one sense, marked the starting point of the mythology of Vince Lombardi. But the context of the Lombardi myth goes back another generation, to an earlier story involving his coach, Jim Crowley. There's a remarkable circle of coincidence in Lombardi's life that began long before he'd ever heard of the place in the small northeastern Wisconsin city of Green Bay. That's where Crowley launched his own football career. He was the backfield star of the 1920 Green Bay East High team that won the state championship when he threw four touchdown passes in the decisive game against Green Bay West, the precision of his spirals aided by a deformed pinky finger on his right hand, which he said helped him better steer the ball. His first high school coach was Earl Curly Lambeau, a local athlete who dropped out of Notre Dame and was also starting up a new professional team back home called the Green Bay Packers. At Lambeau's suggestion, Crowley left Green Bay to play for Newt Rockne at Notre Dame. There he became known as Sleepy Jim, a nickname that perfectly captured his appearance. His whole physical manner suggested relaxation. His ambling gait, his lazy hair parted down the middle, his tired, droopy eyes. It was Rockne who had coined the phrase by describing his recruit as a sleepy-eyed lad who looked as though he were built to be a tester in an alarm clock factory. But Crowley's drowsy aspect disguised a quick wit. To the question of why he seemed so sleepy, he explained in deadpan, "I sleep all right at night and in the morning, but in the afternoon I toss and turn something awful." On the practice field at South Bend, Indiana, one day, Rockne, who was called the Swede by his players, lashed out at Crowley for missing a blocking assignment. "Is there anything dumber than a dumb Irishman?" asked the coach. From Sleepy Jim came the dry retort. "Yeah, coach, a smart Swede." Crowley was not just sleepy and funny. He was also a character in American mythology by the time he reached Fordham. He'd been brought to fame in part by his own running skills, but more by the facile work of a publicist and the melodramatic prose of the greatest mythmaker in American sports, Grantland Rice, who over the course of a half century wrote more than 22,000 stories and 7,000 poems celebrating athletes and their games. Crowley played left halfback at Notre Dame in a backfield that included Don Miller, Harry Stooldreher, and Elmer Layden. The quartet, gritty and undersized, their average weight only 164 pounds, started 22 straight games from 1922 to 1924, losing only once. The 15th game in that streak came against a top-rated Army team at the Polo Grounds on October 18, 1924. Rice covered the contest amid the brotherhood of New York sports writers in the press box, and in loose conspiracy with a sports information man for the Irish. He transformed Sleepy Jim and his backfield mates from mere mortals into football legends, the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame. On the Wednesday before the game, back in South Bend, the Notre Dame players had traipsed over to the Recreation Center in Washington Hall for their ritual road trip Eve movie. Playing on the screen that night was The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, a 1921 silent film starring Rudolph Valentino and based on the mystical book of the same title written by Vicente Blasco Ibáñez. It was a story of greed, hedonism, honor, love, and war, set in Argentina and France before and during World War I. In the movie's pivotal scene, the Valentino character encounters a Christ-like prophet known as the Stranger, who foresees the beginning of the end, the coming of world conflagration, and evokes the four horsemen of the apocalypse from Revelation. They appear as horrifying apparitions on horseback, the helmeted conquest, the hideous war, then pestilence, carrying the scales of famine, and finally the pale rider on the pale horse, death. George Strickler, the Notre Dame public relations man, said he got goosebumps watching the scene where the four horsemen, after appearing one by one, join together and thunder across the screen. The image stayed with him all the way to New York on the train. At halftime of the Army game, as he stood in the press box, gossiping with a group of writers that included Grantland Rice and Damon Runyon, he mentioned that the Irish backs were running through the Army defense just like the horsemen. The next morning, when he leafed through the Sunday edition of the New York Tribune, he realized that Rice had appropriated his idea for what would become the most famous football lead ever written. Polo Grounds, New York, October 18, 1924. Outlined against a blue-gray October sky, the four horsemen rode again. In dramatic lore, they are known as famine, pestilence, destruction, and death. These are only aliases. Their real names are Stuhldreher, Miller, Crowley, and Layden. Strickler's work was not finished. After reading Rice's account, he called his father in South Bend and arranged for him to rent four horses from a corral next to his saloon. At the first practice session after the team's return from New York, photographers were led onto the field to snap the picture of a publicist's dreams. Stuhldreher, Miller, Crowley, and Layden on their mounts, wearing helmets and fearsomely stylish warm-up coats. The shot was distributed nationally above the cut line, "The Four Horsemen of Notre Dame." That phrase and the symbolism of the photograph combined to denote something beyond the prowess of a talented college backfield. All the elements were there for a new myth, born from the old. The leathery men on horseback not only summoned the allegorical riders of the apocalypse from the Book of Revelations, they also connected football to something that had nothing to do with the movie, but everything to do with the photographic image, the mythology of the American West. Swift justice and thrilling violence, the unambiguous world of black hats and white hats, valor and perseverance on the unspoiled plain, all that seemed endangered by the advent of the modern age. But here, within the 100 yards of a football field, was another way to play out America's enduring national myth, the freedom of the frontier. The Old West might be disappearing, but the four horsemen of Notre Dame rode on in the nation's romantic imagination, in league with the silent westerns then being filmed in Hollywood, yet with a more powerful combination of sport, legend, and memory. High on horseback, invincible, Stuhldreher, Miller, Crowley, and Layden became honorable warriors of a lineage that reached deep into the narrative archive, as eternal and illusory as knights of the Middle Ages. Their power in the sporting imagination, like that of medieval knights, arose from the contradiction of the heroic dream described by Dutch historian Johan Huizinga, whose seminal work on the legend of chivalric knights was published contemporaneously with Grantland Rice's rendering of the Four Horsemen. "Reality continuously denies the ideal," Huizinga noted, forcing culture to withdraw further and further back into the sphere of festival and play. Jim Crowley brought the mythology of the horseman with him to Fordham a decade after leaving Notre Dame. On the first day of practice, when he encountered Vince Lombardi and decided to move him to guard, he unwittingly provided the connection from past to future, from one myth to the next. You didn't have to be a big lug to play guard. Crowley copied the system he'd been taught at Notre Dame, preferring what were called watch-charm guards, often 4 inches shorter and 30 pounds lighter than average linemen. The position demanded quickness and tenacity. Lombardi was squat and slow in sprints, with large feet that looked as though they belonged on somebody else's body. But he was quick in short bursts and indisputably tenacious, as was his fellow guard, Nat Pierce. What was most unusual about Lombardi was that he was from New York. The other key recruits in Crowley's first class came out of New England factory towns. Pierce grew up in Biddeford, Maine, on a street whose name, Granite, would later define him. Leo Paquin, a rangy end, was from Brockton, Massachusetts. Joel Dulkey, a fullback, from Lowell. Andy, Handy Andy, Palau, a quarterback and kicker. And Albie Gursky, a halfback, both from Bristol, Connecticut. And Frank Mott, another halfback from New Haven. Among all the varsity and freshman players, only 5 were from New York, while 18 were from Massachusetts alone. During their freshman year, proscribed from varsity competition, Lombardi and his classmates spent most of their time on the practice field learning the Notre Dame box offense and mimicking the opposition in scrimmages against the varsity. The guards, Lombardi and Pierce, spent hour after hour practicing the crossover steps required of them when they pulled out to lead the blocking on sweeps. From his 3-point stance at right guard, pulling right, Vinny would drop his right foot back slightly at the snap, then cross over with his left foot and head out, swerving from the line enough so as not to interfere with other blockers, yet reaching the hole before the swiftest back would make his cut. Crowley's assistants, including line coaches Frank Leahy and Judge Carberry, who also came from Notre Dame, stressed that the key to good line play was the quick start, the sudden hit, taking the momentum away from the defender. One day in practice, Lombardi and Pierce learned just how quick they both were. Mishearing the play, Vinny pulled left while Natty pulled right. They met, full force, behind center, like a head-on car collision, Lombardi later recalled. We both went down. Our pride was hurt. His nearsightedness might have hindered him in that instance, but for the most part his coaches and teammates thought he was a superior blocker precisely because he could hardly see. He hit opposing linemen a split second before he realized he was upon them, which gave him a reckless abandon, never holding back to cushion the blow. Butch was the nickname his teammates gave Lombardi. Appropriate, perhaps, for the grandson of Tony the Barber. And it reflected Vinny's toughness. As rugged as he was, though, the history of his early career at Fordham is primarily a hospital report. He was held out of 3 freshman games with a broken ankle. During spring drills the next May, as Lombardi was preparing for his sophomore season, Crowley and the line coaches began mentioning him as a key backup, if not starter, and by fall preseason workouts his chances seemed bright. Upperclassmen on the line succumbed to injuries one after another. John Waldron dislocated his shoulder and was knocked out for the year, while Amerino Sarno, the rough-neck tackle, fractured his ankle and was hobbling for several weeks. Butch Lombardi saw backup action at guard in the first varsity game of his college career, played at Yankee Stadium instead of the usual polo grounds, a 57-0 thrashing of tiny Westminster of Pennsylvania. Crowley used the mismatch to experiment, using a flexible shift formation in which the guards started in the backfield, aligned with the halfbacks, then jumped into gaps in the line before the snap. Neither the score nor Crowley's offensive creativity proved to be signs of things to come. For the rest of that year, Fordham would be a low-scoring outfit with a conservative offense that relied on a sturdy defense to win ball games. The next weekend, on Columbus Day, Fordham made a rare road trip. Every team wanted to play in New York, where the big crowds and sports writers were, taking the train up to play at Boston College. Early in the game, a starting tackle broke two bones in his hand, further depleting the crippled line corps, and was replaced by Lombardi, who performed admirably despite his lack of size for that position. In several stories the following Monday and Tuesday, as Fordham practiced for its annual visit from St. Mary's of California, Lombardi, projected to start at tackle, had suddenly ballooned into a bulky 200-pounder. Or so said the Fordham Rams publicity department and New York sports writers. Butch actually still weighed about 183 pounds. The Lombardi buildup lasted one day. In the day-to-day ritual of football practice, Wednesday was the most brutal day. The midweek session when the players went at it with game situation ferocity. Crowley trained his men in secret, the workouts closed to students and the press. He was an adherent of long and physical practices, full of wind sprints and odd exercises, like the one-legged bump, in which two players faced off against each other on one leg, holding the other behind them, and bumped shoulders until one hit the ground. Sleepy Jim thought it helped with balance. On Wednesday, he kept the players on the field until they appeared as dim figures scrimmaging in the twilight, identified only by grunts. The final round was all hitting, with backs slamming into the line again and again, and blockers and tacklers, protected only by slender pads and leather helmets without face guards, pounding away in violent scrums at the line. The men often changed positions for the free-for-all. They were not rehearsing plays so much as toughening themselves for the bruises of Saturday and relieving the weekly boredom through unrestrained frenzy. Lombardi loved Bloody Wednesday. Out there on Fordham Field above the gymnasium on Rose Hill, trains from the New York Central rumbling along beyond the fence, Butch in the midst of his teammates, hours of work behind them, letting loose, darkness enveloping the Bronx, the smell of mud and grass and leaves and leather and sweat, thwack and thud, then a big heap on the ground, lying there, exhausted, and up for more. But this time, on the Wednesday before the St. Mary's game, Lombardi did not get up. He'd playfully switched to the backfield in the free-for-all and carried the ball. As players disentangled, Butch was on the bottom of the pile, motionless, groaning loudly, kicked in the gut so hard that he couldn't move. He had to be carried from the field. "Enough," said Crowley, sending his men to the showers. That night Lombardi felt so queasy he couldn't eat. He returned the next day, determined not to lose a chance to start, but collapsed before drills began and was carried off again, semi-conscious. At the infirmary, doctors determined that he was bleeding internally with an aneurysm in his duodenum. If nothing else, a glowing article in Friday's New York Post must have cheered the young casualty, who hadn't started a game, yet was portrayed as a most valuable player. Fordham's dreams of football glory in tomorrow's intersectional gridiron classic with the highly touted Galloping Gales of St. Mary, which will pack the polo grounds to its historic rafters, were all but knocked galley west yesterday, the story began. An injury to Vincent Lombardi, the powerful young Brooklyn sophomore whom Jim Crowley, the Ram coach, had nominated for a starting position at tackle, did it. Lombardi was listed as a starting lineman in the game program, but in fact he was back in the campus infirmary when St. Mary's beat Fordham 14-9, consigned to a bedridden row of maimed football players that included three other linemen and the star halfback, Joe Maniacci. Lombardi was put on a diet of soft foods, ice cream, heavy cream, milk, bananas. The next week, students in his public speaking and religion classes gathered below the window of his infirmary room and shouted up songs and get-well wishes. "Gave him the little rah-rah-rah," classmate Edward J. Schmidlein said. Inspired and still burning for his chance to play, Lombardi dragged himself out of the infirmary that Thursday and reported for practice, surprising Crowley and the Fordham beat writers, who hailed the return of one of the cripples. But Lombardi was so weak that he could play little that week or the next. He was in and out of the lineup the rest of the year, which Fordham completed with a 5-3 record. The Rams lost to three intersectional foes, but won two important games near the end of the season, 13-12, over Major Bob Nalen's powerhouse Tennessee squad, and 39-13 against arch-rival NYU in the muck of Yankee Stadium on Thanksgiving Day. Most of the Fordham starting linemen graduated after that, opening the way for Lombardi and his cohorts to take over. It wasn't easy to meet women at Fordham, where even the cheerleaders were men. The Jesuits didn't entirely discourage dating, but the only women on campus were a few elderly librarians and telephone operators. Joining an organization that traveled away from Rose Hill was the surest way to encounter women. The Fordham Glee Club was especially popular, not just because of its musical tradition, but also its sex appeal. The male singers looked dashing in white ties and tails, and performed at nearby women's schools, including Mount St. Vincent's and the College of New Rochelle. Most campus social clubs sponsored dances, none bigger than the spring formal held by the Brooklyn Long Island Club. 400 Fordham men brought dates to the Hotel Pennsylvania's rooftop across 7th Avenue from Penn Station, where couples danced in tuxedos and gowns to the big band music of Woody Herman and Tommy Dorsey. Lombardi's experience with women had been extremely limited. He played spin the bottle as an adolescent with his cousins over at Grandma Izzo's, but during his years at Cathedral Prep, as he trained for the priesthood, even that innocent game would be considered sinful, material for his confessions. During his year at St. Francis Prep, he was allowed to date, but the girl he asked to the spring prom was his cousin Dorothy Izzo. Finally, at Fordham, largely because of the gregarious attitude of Jim Lawler, his big, glad-handing roommate, Vinnie entered a new world of romance. Lawler had a first cousin at Fordham named Arthur Planets, whose two sisters, Marie and Marge, were then living with their mother in the Bronx in a first-floor apartment at 2564 Creston Avenue, a third of a mile up Fordham Road from campus. Marie had studied nursing at Roosevelt Hospital, but dropped out after getting sick. German Catholic on her father's side and Irish Catholic on her mother's, a Sheridan. She was tall, blonde and blue-eyed, with a figure, recalled several Fordham men, that elicited from them a familiar, ungrammatical locker-room exclamation. "What a built!" With the approval of Marie and Marge, Lawler began bringing Vinnie and other football players to the apartment, sometimes on Saturday nights after the team's banquet of Italian food at the Riviera restaurant on Kingsbridge Road, more often late on Sunday afternoons. Lawler, Lombardi, Leo Paquin, Andy Palau, and a half-dozen more pals sat around munching on pretzels, drinking beer, and telling lies. Marie was quickly taken by Lombardi. "Overwhelmed," she said later, by his maturity, his dark curly hair and brilliant smile. She became his girlfriend, his first and only. Soon after Marie and Vin met, Lawler accompanied them down to Fairhaven, the New Jersey shore town where the Planets family came from and where they maintained a residence. As Marie told the story in later years, after a long day swimming and roaming the beach, she said goodbye to Lombardi, walked into the house and announced to her father, "I'm going to marry that man." "No, you're not, Rep," she remembered her father answering sternly. "He's Italian." Rep was Mortimer Planet's pet name for his daughter, short for reptile. On the surface, Mortimer Planets appeared to be a reserved figure, conservative and status-conscious. He was a stockbroker who dressed in suit and bow tie every day, whether staying home to receive guests or heading to Wall Street to buy and sell on the New York Stock Exchange. He didn't like the idea of his daughter dating the rough-looking son of an Italian butcher from Brooklyn. But Marie's father was in no position to dictate proper behavior to others. He'd long been involved in an illicit, intra-family romance that haunted his wife, Mary, and Marie herself, for the rest of their lives. When Marie was entering high school at Red Bank, New Jersey, Catholic High, near Fairhaven, her father became seriously ill with blood poisoning when his cut foot was infected from the dye in dark socks. He was cared for by Mary's sister, Cass, a nurse, at the family's apartment in the Bronx. During the recovery period, he and Cass fell in love, and they stayed together from then on. It was a debilitating family melodrama, played out in silence and shame. The Planetses, Marie said later, didn't yell and scream or even talk about what was going on. There was no divorce and remarriage, just an unofficial rearrangement. Marie blamed everything on her aunt Cass, not her father. Her mother Mary became a quiet alcoholic and eventually suffered a stroke. She stayed in Fairhaven until her children finished high school, then moved to the apartment in the Bronx, switching residences with Mortimer and Cass. Marie and Marge stayed with their mother while son Arthur attended school at nearby Fordham. Disaffected and confused by the family trauma, Marie tried to lose herself in fun, in search of the next dance, another party, a new young man to meet. Then she encountered Vin Lombardi, who seemed to offer everything that her life lacked. He was emotional, he had a huge family, he was full of life, a varsity athlete, religious and dependable, a relief. Lombardi had been shy in his dealings with women, inarticulate about his deepest feelings, but Marie awakened his dormant romantic side. He showered her with gifts and pastel-colored greeting cards to "Re-Dear" from Vin. She became, almost immediately, the first promoter of his career. During her high school year, she'd preferred to watch football games by standing on the sideline near the boys, and now she was figuratively standing next to her Vince. One day she was with him at an ice cream parlor near campus and saw big Ed Franco coming through the door. Franco, recruited to Fordham from Jersey City, New Jersey, a year after Vin, was also an interior lineman with more raw talent, and loomed as a threat for playing time as Lombardi began his junior year. "So you're Ed Franco. You're the fellow trying to take away my boyfriend's job," Marie said to him. She bet Franco a box of candy that he wouldn't be able to do it. Vin brought Marie home several times in the summer after his sophomore year, when he worked as a lifeguard and special policeman at Brighton Beach, one beach down the shore from his family's summer locker at Manhattan Beach. The Lombardis by then had moved off 14th Street to a new house at the corner of Avenue S and 29th. Vin's brother Harold adored Marie, finding her more artistic than anyone in his own family. But the Lombardi women had trouble with her. Mother Mattie seemed jealous of anyone who threatened to steal the love of her beloved son. "My mother was a very domineering woman, and she would never relinquish Vin," said Harold. Sister Madeline befriended Marie and visited her at the Bronx apartment, occasionally sleeping over, but remained suspicious. If Marie had so much money as she boasted, why did she keep borrowing clothes from Madeline? To her, Marie seemed a bit aloof. "I don't remember her ever showing emotion like I would," Madeline said later. "I thought she was pretty cold. But to an Italian, if you weren't Italian, I guess everybody seemed cold." The year 1935, in the Bronx. Lombardi told the Fordham publicist that his favorite actors were Leslie Howard, Anne Harding, and Helen Hayes. He claimed to be a voracious reader of the books of Richard Halliburton, the daring Hoosier who wrote adventure stories romanticizing his travels around the globe. Vinny and his Fordham teammates paid a quarter to see motion pictures at the Paramount. Another quarter got them a 16-inch pie at the Italian pizzerias up on Arthur Avenue. They received free season passes to Giants games at the Polo Grounds, paying only the 20 cents federal tax. Old Golds, Luckies, cork-tipped Herbert Territons, and menthol spuds, when rah-rah-rah makes your throat raw-raw-raw, light a spud cigarette, went for 15 cents a pack. A night out with Marie, dancing to Irving Kahn and his orchestra at Ben Riley's Arrowhead Inn on Riverdale Avenue, set Vin back a dollar per ticket. Subway fare? A nickel. The Bronx Buick Company on Jerome Avenue advertised a 1934 Pontiac sports coupe, 8 cylinders and rumble seats, for $495. Tickets to Fordham football games at the Polo Grounds cost 50 cents for students. Other fans paid $1.10 to sit in the bleachers, $2.75 for reserved seats, and $3.30 for box seats. A pittance in retrospect. But 50 cents was hard to get in the Depression. It was a half-day's work for Al Lukey, one of Lombardi's classmates, who spent several hours before and after school as an elevator operator at the Barbizon Plaza in Manhattan. The scale of life during Lombardi's college days now seems manageable and innocent. But that's looking through the distorted lens from present to past. Life didn't appear entirely innocent then. In fact, as Lombardi began his junior year at Fordham, a dominant theme in American academic circles was the loss of innocence. Leading scholars feared that universities, reflecting changes evident in modern society, were deteriorating into incoherence, with an emphasis on the particular instead of the whole, on uninterpreted fact instead of fundamental principle, encouraging a hollow worship of fame and success. The inevitable results, they said, were confusion, greed, and self-centeredness. Robert Maynard Hutchins, president of the University of Chicago, delivered a paper asserting that bewilderment was becoming the characteristic feature of the modern world. If a university was to combat that, he said, it must be intelligible as well as intelligent. But if we look at the modern American university, we have some difficulty seeing that it's uniformly either one. It sometimes seems to approximate kindergarten at one end and a clutter of specialists at the other. The fall from grace of American universities, declared Ralph C. Hutchinson, president of Washington and Jefferson College, was evidenced by the shocking number of graduates who have been discovered in corrupt professional practices, in the concealment of corporation assets or liabilities, in the watering of stock, the peddling of questionable securities, the evasion of income and other taxes, the distribution and acceptance of bribes, and the predatory exploitation of public resources. The rise of major college football was part of the debate. After a brief slump at the beginning of the decade, the game had become increasingly popular and profitable again during Lombardi's college years. Attendance figures rose 10% every season from a Depression-era low in 1932, and bulging gate receipts loomed ever larger in the considerations of athletic directors and administrators. Notre Dame drew more than 53,000 spectators to every game. Navy-led Eastern schools with an attendance average of 44,000, with Fordham close behind. But along with enormous growth came complaints that the sport had compromised the integrity of the universities and made laughable the ideal of amateur competition. Even the Marx Brothers were laughing. Their 1932 Horse Feathers was a send-up on the college recruitment of dumb football players. The professionalization of college football dated back at least to 1891, when the University of Chicago hired the first coach at a professor's salary, Amos Alonzo Stagg. Now Chicago's president, Hutchins, was questioning the relevance of football to the educational mission. He'd forced Stagg to leave in 1932 and was in the process of de-emphasizing football. Before the decade was out, he would eliminate it at Chicago altogether. The college game was all but invented by Yale's Walter Camp, who conceived the modern scrimmage rules, attempted to deepen the significance of the game with his analogies to warfare and corporate management, and glorified the players with his annual All-American teams. But in 1931, the death of an Eli player had led some to conclude that the warfare analogy had gone too far. And now Yale's president, James Roland Angel, stood out among the game's leading critics. During the 1935 season, Angel lambasted the commercialization of collegiate athletics, saying that football had succumbed to a hired man policy. "College football has become in many instances big business," he said. "Today in college football, it's the crowd, the winners, the receipts that count above everything else in 70% of the institutions." Angel offered three alternatives. One, seek endowments to make athletics independent of gate receipts. Two, allow athletics to carry on unaided by college. Or three, abandon college sports. His comments received major coverage. Most sports columnists ridiculed his preaching. A careful perusal of the Constitution fails to reveal that the makers of that document were greatly concerned with the possible advantages which might accrue to a youth weighing more than 150 pounds and lucky enough to kick a football more than 40 yards, wrote Hugh Bradley. Most editorial writers picked up the cause, however, as did other public officials. Governor Martin L. Davey of Ohio sarcastically called football the supreme purpose of higher education and complained that Ohio State players were stashed on the state payroll. To recruit top players, the university and its boosters found no show or easy jobs for 14 athletes in the state highway department, sales tax division, and motor vehicle department, or at the Capitol as legislative pages, elevator operators, or clerks. The Reverend Patrick J. Mann, S.J., of Creighton University, said that big-time college football presented an inherent contradiction. "I am convinced, and reasonably so, that no regular player is on a big team without being paid. He does not, out of his own pocket, pay for his tuition, fees, board, and lodging. Yet authorities of universities decry the subsidizing of athletics," said Mann, concluding, "If you sit in at a crooked game, you must be crooked if you expect to win." During his first 3 years at Fordham, Jim Crowley heard no complaints from his Jesuit superiors about the dominance of big-time college football on campus. His problem with Father Aloysius J. Hogan, the school's president, was of an entirely different sort. Hogan had little use for academics who disliked football. Crowley's problem with his boss was that here was a Jesuit who thought he knew everything about sports. Every Monday during football season, shortly after lunch, Hogan would slip into Sleepy Jim's blue Packard parked outside the campus's Bathgate entrance, puff on his pipe, and launch into a soliloquy on the tactics the coach might employ for the next game. Crowley ignored the advice, but endured the lectures, which were a quiet source of amusement to others in the athletic department, though not to Jack Coffey, who faced the same situation with his baseball team. Once, after Coffey's ball club lost a game 18-2, Father Hogan was beside himself, saying there was no reason they should have lost by such a score. "I help out as much as I can," the father lamented, "but the exigencies of the job are endless, and I cannot be in two places at one time." His junior year was the most frustrating of Butch Lombardi's career. He began the season as the regular right guard, but injured his shoulder in a 13-7 victory over visiting Vanderbilt, and soon lost his job to Ed Franco. Whether this prompted Marie to pay off her bet and give Franco a box of candy is lost in history, but it did cause her boyfriend to sulk. Franco not only played, he became a star, part of a tough front line that shut out Pitt in a scoreless tie and stifled the offense of talented St. Mary's in a 7-7 tie. The front seven linemen performed so strongly that Fordham's publicist gave them a nickname, the Seven Samsons. Lombardi was relegated to a backup group of shock troops who spelled the regulars at the start of the game and again in the third quarter. Still, his injury jinx persisted, even with limited playing time. He twisted an ankle against Pitt and got elbowed in the mouth so hard in the St. Mary's game that his lower teeth were knocked loose. He wore a bridge for the rest of his life. He was the constant companion of trainer Jake Weber, the diminutive Dutchman known as 80-Minute Jake, who could single-handedly tape the ankles of the entire 40-man squad, 80 ankles in 80 minutes. Harry Lombardi's old admonition to his son, "Hurt is all in your mind," was only partially true. Vinny was hurting body and soul. One Saturday night, stuck alone in his room at St. John's with an injury, he spotted classmate James Ambury walking down the abandoned hallway and called him in for help. "Would you get me a priest?" Lombardi asked. "I need to go to confession, but I can't move." Sleepy Jim's entire team felt frustrated that year. The two ties and a 20-0 thumping by Purdue had dropped the Rams from the top national rankings. Thinking that Fordham had no chance against Jock Sutherland's Pitt team, New York's sports writing fraternity had largely ignored what proved to be Fordham's finest defensive outing in years, choosing instead to take the overnight train to Columbus to cover the Notre Dame versus Ohio State matchup. But after stopping Pittsburgh, Fordham's players were convinced they were the best squad in the East going into the season finale against rival NYU, which, with an easier schedule, was unbeaten in 7 games and anticipating a bowl berth. Before the game, the New York Evening Journal, Harry Lombardi's favorite paper, thought it had a scoop. Fordham's 2 senior stars, running back Joe Maniacci and tackle Amerino Sarno, reported that 2 flashily dressed gamblers driving an expensive car approached them outside the practice field at Fordham and offered them $1,000 each to throw the game. As Maniacci told the story to the newspaper, "Sarno and I were on our way to the gym to change our clothes. 2 fellows got out of their car. One guy asked, 'You guys need any money?' I said, 'Who doesn't?' The fellow asked me if I'd like to make a G for myself and made Sarno the same offer. We laughed. 'What do you want us to do?' The fellow said, 'We're a couple of bookies and we stand to make a lot of money on this game if we know which way it's going to go. All we want you guys to do is make it sure for us. You, Maniacci, you fumble that ball whenever you can. And you, Sarno, make your tackles miss. In other words, dog it.'" Hours before the game the next day, Maniacci and Sarno reported the bribe attempt to Sleepy Jim and their teammates. The story enraged the squad, pumping them up even more for the crucial contest, which was played on Thanksgiving Day before a boisterous sellout crowd of 75,000 at Yankee Stadium. Fordham dominated the Violets, winning 21-0. Led by the offensive play of halfback Maniacci and quarterback Handy Andy Palau, who caught a touchdown pass, intercepted 2 passes, punted, returned punts, and won the Maydow Trophy as the game's most valuable player. Lombardi spent the first quarter on the sideline, but rushed the field with a band of teammates in the second quarter when Sarno got into a fistfight with NYU tackle Perry Gaffin. When the brawl ended, Sarno and Gaffin were tossed from the game, and the hole in the line gave Lombardi some unexpected playing time at guard. At midfield after the game, Crowley encountered NYU coach Mal Stevens, whose Rose Bowl hopes had just been crushed. "I'm sorry, Mal," Crowley said. "That's all right, Jim," said Stevens. "Maybe I can do as much for you someday." Up in the press box, Damon Runyon, covering the game for the New York American, banged out his familiar telegram-style lead, addressing it to the Rose Bowl committee. "Dear gents, sorry we'll be unable to meet you in Rose Bowl. Stop. We used everything possible against Fordham, including our Dukes, but we're de-emphasized again. Stop. They have tough chins. Stop. suggest worthy opponent for you would be Andrew Palau and any 10 other fellows. Stop. Love and Kisses. The Violets. New York University. The next day, Father Harold Mulqueen, the prefect at St. John's Hall, where the football players lived, confronted Maniaci and Sarno after being told by police detectives that the bribe story appeared questionable. The seniors finally confessed to the priest. They had concocted it. Their only motive from the beginning, they said, was to inspire the team, which indeed they had, and the lopsided victory restored Fordham to national renown. The final polls ranked the Rams 11th in the country. There was one final bit of controversy for the Fordham football team that school year, and Lombardi was in the middle of it. It happened during spring practice. As the men were going through drills in preparation for the 1936 season, which would be Lombardi's last, he felt unsure of his standing on the team. Sleepy Jim had been picking on him, making him feel that he could do nothing right. Late one afternoon, after a discouraging session, Lombardi was taking a shower when he was approached by Richard Healy, another senior-to-be who was feeling equally frustrated after 3 years as a second-string end. Healy was known as a practical joker, and this time he went too far. He called Lombardi a wop and told another player to stand next to him to see who was darker. Lombardi was enraged. He tackled Healy to the hard shower floor and punched him several times before Leo Paquin and a few other teammates broke it up. Blood flowed into the shower drain as Healy and Lombardi were taken to the infirmary. "I got an egg on my head, and he got some stitches in his forehead," Lombardi later recalled. Healy said he got the worst of it in the exchange of blows and carried the shame of what he had done for the rest of his life. "I agonized over it for years. It haunted me. It was another dumb trick, a dumb Irish trick. I regret that. It was a sad moment in my life." Fordham had a new president that spring, Father Robert I. Gannon, S.J., who didn't think much of big-time college football. When he heard about the shower room fight, he considered it evidence that the violent game was making brutes of young men, turning them away from the responsible traditions of the Jesuits. He suspended both players from the team. Lombardi was stunned. "I thought," he said later, "that it was the end of my career." Chapter 3. We Do or Die. 10 days before the Fordham football squad opened its 1936 season, a young sports writer for the Associated Press visited the practice field at Rose Hill to assess the team's prospects for the coming year. This Cub reporter for the AP later gained journalistic renown as James R. Reston, Washington editor and columnist for the New York Times. But in his early days, he covered sports under the informal byline Scotty Reston. Writing in the clipped and matter-of-fact style of the wire service, Reston centered his preseason account on a quote from the coach that was predictable both for its humor and pessimism. "I feel at home with this squad because they're big and I can't pronounce their names," said Sleepy Jim Crowley. "But we're playing so many tough teams that we can have a very good year and still lose almost every ball game." The 8-game schedule, Reston pointed out, featured first-rate teams from every corner of the nation. Southern Methodist from the Southwest, St. Mary's from California, Purdue from the Midwest, and Georgia from the South, along with powerhouse Pittsburgh and NYU in the traditional finale. But Crowley had 16 top lettermen returning, and not even his droll pessimism could diminish the great expectations for his team in his fourth year as coach. Reston appraised this as Fordham's biggest, fastest, and most promising squad in years. His competitor at the New York Sun, Edwin B. Dooley, in a story headlined, "Ram Team May Be Best in History of Institution," wrote his season setter in more effusive prose. Everyone on the campus, from the clerks in the office to the gardeners on the lawn, was talking about it. All of them wanted to know if you had heard about the team Jim Crowley is going to have this year. If you hadn't, it was a pity, for it was an absolute fact, you were informed, that the Maroon Machine will be the best ever to set foot on Fordham's practice field. The stories noted that the strength of the team would be its seven-man line, led by a rugged junior who played center on offense and backer-up, what linebackers were called then, on defense. He was the player Reston identified as the great unpronounceable. 6 foot, 200-pound Alexander Franklin Wojciechowicz, who was being promoted for All-American honors as Woji, his more pronounceable nickname. It was said that the sound of his blocks and tackles was so distinctive, a clean and sharp smack, that even a blind man could tell if Woji had made the play. Starting up front with him would be ends Leo Paquin and Johnny Tarzan Drews, tackles Ed Devil Doll Franco and Al Alibaba Barbartsky, both of whom had been moved out from guard, leaving left guard for Natty Pierce and right guard for Vin Lombardi. At last, Lombardi was a fixture in the starting lineup, the beneficiary of the persuasive powers and football judgment of Crowley. First, the coach intervened with Father Gannon to lift Lombardi's and Healy's suspensions. Then he and line coach Frank Leahy concluded that they could field the sturdiest forward wall by moving surplus guard talent to tackle, where two vacancies had been left by graduation. The new line Crowley built for the 1936 season from left to right. Paquin, Franco, Pierce, Woji, Lombardi, Babartsky, and Drews. Before the era of two-platoon football, these seven were almost 60-minute men, playing both ways all season with occasional substitutions, the most frequent being Harry Jakunski at end for the oft-injured Paquin. On offense, they responded fiercely to Crowley's familiar sideline refrain. "Blockers! More blockers!" he would shout. On defense, they became known as the Seven Blocks of Granite, an evocative epithet that made the 1936 season memorable and blessed the Fordham linemen with a permanent place in football lore. For one among them, the scrappy right guard, already 23 years old, his uneven playing career nearing an early end, it served an even greater purpose. The figurative block of granite became a cornerstone in the construction of the mythology of Vince Lombardi. On the eve of the season opener, Crowley paced the floor of his apartment on East 96th Street in Manhattan. This late-night pacing had become a ritual for him, as he turned over in his mind every play that might go wrong the next day. Up at the Fordham campus, nine of his veteran players gathered in the St. John's Hall room of Dick Healy to tell stories and play craps for dimes on the bed. Butch Lombardi came, the bruises of his shower brawl with Healy forgotten. Paquin, considered the intellect of the group, was interviewing his teammates for a weekly column he wrote for the Fordham Ram. The players were in fine physical and mental condition, Paquin determined, and were anxiously awaiting the coach's signal to go get 'em, boys. Woji said he was eager for the St. Mary's Gales to blow into town. Frank Mott, captain and halfback, was expecting trouble from Pittsburgh, which had already started its season and had rung up 53 points in the opener. Franco was nervous about his move to tackle and looking forward to playing the Southern Methodist gang for thrills. Lombardi said he had a score to settle with Purdue, which had dealt the Rams their only loss the previous season. Andy Palau, still frustrated by Sleepy Jim's cautious offense, said he expected to pass more this year. The answers were classic ballplayer clichés, none more so than the one Paquin elicited from Johnny Drews. "I'm not looking ahead to anyone but Franklin and Marshall," the opening day opponent, Drews said, noting that assistant coach Hugh DeVore saw them play last Saturday and reports a great club. Not so great, it turned out. The year before, Franklin and Marshall had surprised Fordham, losing only 14-7. This time, Fordham ran up 66 points before the diplomats from Pennsylvania finally scored in the closing seconds by falling on a blocked punt in the end zone. The Rams' offense looked unstoppable, gaining 308 yards on the ground and another 98 through the air on 6 of 7 passes. It wasn't entirely the wide-open attack Palau was hoping for, but impressive enough. But the offense created by Crowley, the old horseman, turned from apocalyptic to meek after that first week. Southern Methodist came into New York next, and from the start, all attention was on the visitors from Dallas, who arrived like a traveling circus replete with mascot pony, marching jazz band, and an official sweetheart named Marianne Collins. Riding east by train, the SMU pageant reached Grand Central Station at 10:45 Friday morning. While the players relaxed at the Hotel Croydon, the jazz band and its official sweetheart wowed New York, parading double time down 42nd Street and performing at the Madison Square Garden Rodeo. At the Polo Grounds the next day, Southern Methodist revived the circus atmosphere by keeping the ball high. The Mustangs threw more passes than Fordham might attempt in a full season, 48, and gained 213 yards passing to 0 for the Rams. But for all their showmanship, they could not score. 6 times, Fordham's defenders were pushed deep into their own territory. Each time, they stopped SMU from crossing the goal line. The visitors grew desperate as the afternoon darkened, until finally they threw one too many. Johnny Locke intercepted a long SMU pass and raced 75 yards for the game's only score. Fordham had been outplayed all day, but still won 7-0, maintaining its national standing. In the locker room afterwards, Sleepy Jim and his players acknowledged that they'd been lucky. But Johnny Locke was a shaky hero, nauseous since reaching the end zone. In the excitement of the moment, dashing downfield on his run to glory, he'd swallowed a wad of tobacco. Lombardi was an inveterate talker on the field, always yapping, aggressive, barking, "Come on, let's go!" There were times when Andy Palau had to tell him to hold it down so he could call the play. Number 40 was the bossy older brother to his partners along the line, shoving them around even though they were all bigger, demanding more from them even though they were all better. The better we became, the tougher and meaner Vinny got all the time. He felt it was his obligation to instill religion in the younger players, said Tarzan Drews. The other members of the line were comparatively quiet. Woji, a good-natured quipster out of uniform, turned mum in the locker room before a game and let his hitting speak for him until it was over. Natty Pierce, Drews, and Devil Doll Franco occasionally threw wisecracks and taunts across the line to opposing players, but only Butch was incessantly talking to himself and his teammates. His eyelids blinked furiously. "Damn it, what's going on here?" When he missed a block or thought a play had been fouled up, he hustled back to the huddle seething like a madman, in the words of his line coach, Frank Leahy, who worried that Lombardi was always treading a thin line between competitiveness and fanaticism. "There never was a more aggressive man who played for me than Vincent. There were times when I genuinely worried that he might be too aggressive." He impressed the more talented Woji as a battler, a fighting guard who never took any guff from anybody. But he rarely let his emotions interfere with his concentration for the next play. As the quarterback in Crowley's Notre Dame box formation, Palau lined up a few yards behind the center, then shifted to the left or right before the snap, often ending up behind the right guard. On many plays, he and Lombardi had the same blocking assignment, pulling out to double-team an opposing tackle or guard, then hitting the defender from the inside, Handy Andy from the outside. They were not the most intimidating sight coming at you. Palau, a bony 165 pounds, 20 less than Lombardi, and both were slow afoot, but they were persistent and smart. They developed their own internal blocking signals. If one thought he could handle the tackler alone, he would yell, "Ice!" And the other would turn upfield looking for a backer-up to block instead. Vinny was